70. I'm
quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And Lars. Now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
What they've done to that place is it's like living in hell.
Yep, that's the President of the United States, Donald John Trump. And what is he talking about? He's talking about the city of Portland, Oregon. And of course, he puts Seattle in the same bunch as well, because the border czar for Donald Trump has said that ICE operations are going to soon ramp up. He said after Labor Day, and we are definitely after Labor Day in Seattle and Portland. And why? Well, listen to what Donald Trump says about what they plan to do.
We're going to go into another place and straighten it out. And I will say this. I watched today. I didn't know that was continuing to go on. But Portland is unbelievable what's going on in Portland. Destruction of the city.
Yep. Destruction of the city. Now, what do you hear when you talk to local politicians? I'll get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, and I may get some naysayers on this, 866-439-5277, and you go to the head of the list. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new question each and every day from the news of the day. You'll find the question on X at Lars Larson Show. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com, but we're a conservative program, so please only vote once. Even if you're a Democrat and you're inclined to vote more than once, just vote one time. But what do the city officials in places like Seattle and Portland say? They say they're awfully mad. In fact, Keith Wilson, the mayor of Portland, says, "I have not asked for and do not need federal intervention." Well, he may have forgotten that his predecessor actually called for the National Guard to be brought into Portland because they'd allow riots to go on for more than 100 days. Now, that was only a couple of years ago, but he says no federal intervention is needed. And yet our friends at the Taxpayers Association point out multiple law enforcement personnel have been injured during the recent, this year, Portland ICE riots. Nearby residents who happen to live in the riot zone have been assaulted. Three independent journalists have been assaulted. Schools have been closed due to the riots, at least the nearby schools to the riots. Police are unable to enforce open lawbreaking that goes on every single night. And it's not hard at all. Independent journalists go down there, they shoot video, and they show the kind of plight that the people who happen to live in that area and may not be able to relocate. They've got tear gas going on. They've got noise into the late evening hours or the early morning hours. Residents nearby can't even open up their windows because of the tear gas used for riot control and large volume of smoke bombs that is used by the protesters. Local shops have been losing business as rioters damage the windows. And of course, customers, do they want to go anywhere near that place? Of course not. And anti-ICE protesters shut down the Portland mayor's recent speech. He actually tried to hold an event. They forced him to leave the area. And free speech is under attack in public. Law enforcement officials, including ICE agents, have had their names, addresses, and pictures of their family members posted online. Well, President Trump says he's seen enough of this and he wants it to stop.
And you see it with the signs. You know, they all have perfect signs and are printed. They look as good as that sign. Those signs aren't made in basements. They're made at professional printing offices and they cost a lot of money. These are paid agitators and they're very dangerous for our country. And when we go there, if we go to Portland, we're going to wipe them out. They're going to be gone, and they're going to be gone fast. They won't even stand the fight. They will not stay there. They've ruined that city.
Yep, and I think he's absolutely right about it. And here's what I think the folks in both the leadership of Portland and Seattle are afraid of. They have watched what has happened in about the last month in Washington, D.C. Now, Washington, D.C. may or may not have been the best place to start, but Donald Trump, as president of the country, had authority over Washington, D.C., because unlike every other city in America, all other cities are created by the states they exist within. So the city of Seattle, city of Tacoma, they exist because the Washington legislature says so. City of Portland, city of Eugene, city of Medford, they exist because the legislature authorized them. In the case of Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. exists as the seat of the national government. It is not in a state, and it owes all of its allegiance to the federal government. The Congress controls them. Now, about 40 years ago, Washington, D.C. got home rule authority, which gave them the right to have their own charter, write some of their own laws, maintain their own institutions like police and fire and the rest. But the fact is, they have never been out from under federal control. Trump exercised that control about a month ago. And I want you to consider the kind of revelation or the kind of turnover that he showed in Washington, D.C. The mayor of that city, just like the mayors of Portland and Seattle, complained all day long for about the first 2 weeks about what Donald Trump was doing. And she vowed, Donald Trump will not be welcome here. We do not want him to take over. And then about a week or 10 days ago, Muriel Bowser changed her tune entirely. And why? Because violent assault was down 50%. Armed robberies were down about 40%. Carjackings were down almost 90%. And all of a sudden, Muriel Bowser said, hey, this is working. And she has since then said, maybe we will keep up this partnership with what Donald Trump brought to our city. Now, was any of what was done by Donald Trump not possible to do by local officials? Of course they could have done it. They chose not to. They chose to allow violence and crimes to run rampant. And so have the mayors of places like Portland and Seattle. So now Donald Trump says, I'm going to go in there. And what do the city officials say? They're scared to death that if Donald Trump takes over the situation, even for a short period of time, by putting federal officers on the streets, including ICE, including FBI, including National Guard mobilized from outside the state of Oregon or the state of Washington, they're afraid that it's actually going to work. And the fact is, Trump has the right read on what these mobs in the streets amount to. Listen to this.
You know, that was not on my list, Portland, but when I watched television last night, this has been going on. You wouldn't be standing if you were the mayor. You would be. Can you imagine what they're doing? They're walking in throwing smoke bombs into stores. These are paid terrorists, okay? These are paid agitators. These are professional. I watched that last night. I'm very good at this stuff. These are paid agitators.
And he's absolutely right about that. And we know some of the people, names like George Soros and the Tides Foundation and everything else. They fund this nonsense because they want chaos in America. And guess what just happened today? The U.S. Supreme Court has lifted the restrictions on immigration stops. These were being done in Los Angeles. The same kind of thing could be done in other American cities. Now, what the liberals had complained about, including people like Sonia Sotomayor, she says we should not live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, or appears to work a low-wage job. Rather than standing by idly where our constitutional freedoms are lost, I dissent. Well, her dissent lost. The majority of the Supreme Court said, you bet, you can go out there and you can round people up who are illegally in the country. And you know, the mayors of sanctuary cities like Seattle and Portland, they are scared to death that Trump is going to do it. And when he rounds up a lot of those law-breaking illegal aliens, crime goes down and they end up with egg on their faces. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next. It's...
LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, quick question. Which laws do the rest of us get to break without having any consequences at all? I'm talking about the thoroughly illegal strike by classified workers in the Evergreen Public Schools. Their labor unions declared a strike and 1,400 workers walked off the job to extort raises from citizens and parents who get hurt by such strikes. The school district finds itself in a financial hole, $26 million short. So it made a final offer and the unions rejected it. Then the workers went on strike, a strike that breaks state law. Nearly every time, school boards refuse to call out the unions for this kind of nonsense. Well, on Friday, the Evergreen Public School Board approved a resolution to take legal action, go to Clark County Superior Court, and demand an injunction against the union. I hope they get it. That's a good start, but only if the district actually follows through. Usually, schools don't properly represent the people by demanding that workers and their unions follow the law. They often cave in. They pay what's demanded. They drive the district further into the red, and then they demand that the taxpayers put up more cash to pay the extortion and often, crazy enough, pay workers for the days they didn't work during the strike. I'm crossing my fingers that this time can be different. As the good book says, if you don't work, you don't eat. And a little starvation might just straighten out some of those unions. Fine to get your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you'd get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Brent Gunderson writes, and Lars, I got a card in the mail from the Multnomah County Elections Division stating my voter registration is inactive. How? Who did that? I vote every election. What's going on here? I went to My Vote Online and saw the same thing. I sent in the postcard stating I am still registered. I'll keep an eye on it. Cheers, Brent Gunderson. Well, Brent, let me know what's going on. And today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to Representative Cyrus Javidi. He is a state lawmaker who comes from the Tillamook area where I went to high school. Javidi apparently did a bait and switch on voters. About a year ago, he's telling the voters he's conservative. Now, all of a sudden, he completely identifies with the Democrat Party. If you want to do that, quit your position and then run as a Democrat and see whether or not you get elected. If you sold the voters a bill of goods and effectively lied to them about where you stood on positions and issues, and then you got your office, you don't deserve to keep that office. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes because I had them do it for me. The result is beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Dan Pinkston says, Lars, you can use my full name if you want to. So is it true that in Oregon and Washington, you can get unemployment pay if you go on strike? Yep. Also, I understand that school employees can also get unemployment while off during the summer. I don't know whether that's true or not. It may depend on the individual arrangements between that worker and the school district. He said, I work at Chemeketa Community College in Salem, did for 25 years. When I went to work there, I knew I was a 10-month employee, so for 2 months, I had to work another job when there was no money then. When you go to work, you know it up front. It's BS if people get unemployment when they are considered a full-time employee and they have a job to come back to. Also, if you go on strike, it's your choice. You can work if you want to. Yes, I am upset with this crap. We need a ballot measure to put it to a vote and change it. And my name is Dan Pinkston. Dan, thank you very much for that. Let me go to Logan. Hey, Logan, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind on this nice Monday? Logan? I think Logan may have dropped off the line on me, or he's not listening to his phone. So give him one more try. Logan? Nope, not there. S, welcome to the program. You go by the initial S?
Oh, yes. Hello. How are you doing?
Just great. What's on your mind?
So I just wanted to let you know that I'm somebody that has a job that You know, I drive up and down I-5, and I've been all around the areas you're talking about. I've been to Portland. I've been to Seattle. I stop at all the truck stops and, you know, stay at all the hotels, and it's,
That's a great travelogue, Es, but is there a point involved in what you called about other than telling us where you drive?
No, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, I've been around Portland area and Seattle all up and down I-5, and, you know, one of the things that really sucks for folks like me who are trying to do our job is, you know, I don't really care about Democrats or Republicans. I'm just really tired of everybody fighting. I just want to go back to work, man. I'm really tired that I can't get any medical care. I'm really tired.
Hold on. You want to go back? You don't have a job, but you drive up and down the freeway for no reason? Why are you driving up and down the freeway?
When did I say I didn't have a job?
You just said, I just want to go back to work. I want a job. I thought I heard you say that, didn't you?
I have a job. I want to go back to my old job because I'm too disabled to do my old job. Now I do this job, and I want medical care to be able to go back to my old job just so I can stay in one place. I'm sick and tired of driving.
Dump it. When he uses language like that, the FCC does not think kindly of me if I allow people to use language like that. So we dump that call. Sorry, folks. If you're going to use one of George Carlin's 7 dirty words, we're going to end up dumping your call, and that means S gets banned for a period of time. Can't have that kind of language on the air, or the FCC would have my shirt and probably the shirt of my boss as well. Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. I do want to mention this. This is the way the Business Tribune tells it, but it's here in the Pacific Northwest. It involves both states. A billion-dollar taxpayer-funded enterprise to kickstart a clean energy industry, hydrogen industry in the Pacific Northwest, took another hit due to energy companies getting cold feet. I think Business Tribune is being a bit dishonest about that. What happened was Portland General Electric and its partner Mitsubishi Power were going to start producing hydrogen, which is a great energy carrier, but it is an energy oven by itself. They were going to have a storage and hydrogen fuel generation complex near Boardman. Now, why did they drop out? Because their feet got cold? No, they dropped out because the federal subsidies disappeared. PGE spokesman Drew Hansen says, given the exit of an essential project partner in June, along with the challenging project economics for utility customers and federal policy changes, PGE is no longer pursuing the hydrogen complex. Now, there are a lot of people who get excited about hydrogen. Hydrogen is great for carrying energy, but you have to make it out of something. If you make it out of natural gas, the environmentalists get all excited and verklempt. If you make it out of electricity, it costs more than it's actually worth. It's a dumb idea, and the only way it works is with federal subsidies. I'm glad that those federal subsidies have gone away. I wish Business Tribune would actually tell the truth. All these big companies have decided to pull out because the free checks from Washington, D.C. just disappeared. Back in a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. As you know, we are still in the middle of a special session of the legislature. It began before Labor Day weekend. It continues now because one member of the Democrat Party who's a senator is ill and may or may not be back in a week or 10 days to actually vote to finish this thing up. Now, the legislature took 2 swings at major increases in taxes to fund ODOT and their mismanagement of literally billions of dollars. And they have mismanaged billions of dollars. They didn't get anywhere with those 2 tries. Then they had the special session. They got it through the House just barely with one sellout Republican named Javidi. And he's now become a Democrat. And we've still got to wait and see whether or not the legislature will finish up and give this money to ODOT. They don't need the money. They have the money within their existing budget. They just simply want more. And I don't think any reasonable person would say, gosh, you've mismanaged billions of dollars of our money. And now, since you've run short, we're going to give you more. What kind of idiot would do that? But most of the public officials who showed up to testify testified in favor of the tax increase. One of them who said something to the contrary, and I saw some of his testimony, Scott Kaiser, who is mayor of Molalla, who joins me now. Mayor Kaiser, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And I don't want to color your point of view on this. I don't think I could anyway, even if I tried. But what should we think when ODOT comes and says, hey, we need more money, or all the basic services that ODOT supposedly delivers to the public are not going to be there? We're still going to fund all the other salaries, but we won't be able to do the basics for the people. As mayor of Molalla, what do you think of that?
Well, the basics for our city has been nothing for the last 25 years. We've had some new development come into our city. They've let the warranties go on what that new development was supposed to do with Highway 211 coming through our city. Now we have base rock failing, and we have potholes coming in, and they're saying, well, sorry, we'll come fix it. And they haven't. They've put sidewalks, walkways in our city where the rain drains are sitting an inch and a half above the walkway, which makes a trip hazard. We brought that up to them. Their inspectors approved this for the contractor to move on, and we appointed this out to them 3 years ago. They still haven't come.
So when you see all these other mayors and public officials show up to the legislature to testify in favor of a big tax increase for the folks at ODOT who haven't done the job for a town like Molalla, what do you think people should make of that?
I should make it a big cash grab. They've overplanned themselves a lot farther than they should. If this doesn't go through, we're not laying off our maintenance workers in our city like Portland is. If they got to lay off people because this doesn't go up, then they were counting on money that was never there to begin with. That is poor fiscal management on cities that are doing that.
But then again, you're talking about an agency, Mayor Kaiser, and I'm sure you know this as well as I do, that overestimated its income by $1 billion, spent on that basis, and then went to the legislature hat in hand and said, hey, we overspent our checking account by $1 billion. Could you please make it up? This is the kind of mismanagement that's going on, and I haven't heard of anyone getting fired or disciplined at that agency. Have you?
No one has. And it's mismanagement from the start. They haven't looked at any of the mistakes they've made and said, hey, we screwed up. Let's make changes. And again, just like you said before, the money's there. The governor wouldn't be allowing them to not go on strike if the money wasn't sitting there, because where is she getting it from? She doesn't have the printer to make it.
No, but there are things, I mean, my view is that ODOT could take a lot of its planned projects, some of which I think are already functionally dead, like the Rose Quarter and the I-5 Bridge, and they're dead. They're dead items right now. They could say, those right. things are dead, we take the money we've set aside for those things, and we spend them on current needs.
Correct. Well, the Interstate Bridge is a great example. How many hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent? They haven't broke ground. There are already $800,000 over budget on the Abernathy Bridge. Lars, I drive
800
over
million.
That bridge.
Sorry, 800 million. I know in Molalla the budgets are more in hundreds of thousands. Look, I'm not diminishing Molalla. It's a great town. But down at the legislature, they don't even pay any attention to anything less than seven figures.
Right. Well, and I drive over the Abernathy Bridge every single day with my day job. Those cranes that are sitting in the water aren't moving. They're doing nothing, and it's already behind budget. It's absolutely ridiculous. As a city, we have to be fiscally responsible. And I'm just, unfortunately, I don't see a hope that this is not going to pass, unfortunately. And thank God there's some people out there that are looking at a referendum so we can fight this. And then I pray to God that people remember this come next year when we're voting.
I couldn't agree with you more. And Mayor Kaiser, by the way, I got word Friday. I'd been wondering about this for a couple of years, and I kept making calls during Biden, and I couldn't get the Coast Guard to call me back. Friday, I got word back from the Coast Guard. Do you know one thing you absolutely have to build any bridge over that river? You have to have Coast Guard approval. You know what the Coast Guard told me? They said, we have approved a bridge at 178 feet. We have not approved anything else. They are planning to build it at 116 feet, about 62 feet short. And I asked them, right. I said, well, what do they say in their current application? They said the Interstate Bridge Project has not applied for a bridge at any height. They haven't even applied, and they're planning to break ground next year. It's like telling you that I'm going to build a house in Malala, and you say, did you get your building permit? I said, no, I'll deal with that when we first stick a shovel in the ground. You say, you can't do it that way. That's the way ODOT is doing it. I think they know the project is dead, because the minute the Coast Guard comes back and formally tells them, you cannot build a bridge at 116, then Greg Johnson's six-figure salary goes away.
Exactly.
So what is going to happen in Malala even if this gets approved? Do you expect any of the improvements or the finishing up of old projects that ODOT promised you?
No, not at all, Lars. We've been, like I said, 25 years. Highway 211, it's been repaved from our city to Estacada. It's been repaved from our city to Woodburn. Nothing down our main street. And I don't see that getting fixed. I don't see, the potholes, they may come out and put some tar in, but they're not going to fix that infrastructure underneath the asphalt. And for 3 years, we've been waiting for them to fix that tripping rain drain that doesn't even collect rain. The water's bypassing and going into people's property.
So why do you suppose Tina Kotek does not fire some of the people at ODOT and hire some competent managers?
Because I think the unions are writing checks to her campaign.
Yeah,
It's the only logical reason for it.
Do you suppose there's any other city the size of Malala or about that size who's got the same view you do? And if so, why aren't they saying so to the legislature?
There's a lot of cities that have the same view, and I don't know why they're not speaking up. The majority of the cities that you'll hear speaking, such as the day I went in and spoke, are the larger cities in Oregon. You got your Portland, Bend, Eugene, Salem. They're the ones that want this, and they're speaking up. I would have to think it's for the cash grab, because ODOT does not have that many highways going through their cities like we do as a main artery through ours.
Yeah, I think you're in an entirely different position. Mayor Kaiser, anything else you want to tell the folks about what's going on? Because they are going to vote, and I think you may be right, they'll pass it, but they're going to jack up taxes, and they're not going to get the work done that they promised to do. They're too busy funding their big projects.
Right. The only thing we're asking is that people nicely email Senator Meek. He seems to be the possible one that's on the bubble. And then also email a Representative Hartman and thank her for her one, she was the one Democrat that voted against this, and thank her for standing tall for her community, because her community is not that much different than ours.
No doubt. That is Mayor Scott Kaiser, the mayor of Malala, Oregon. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And in Pierce County, they've arrested a 13-year-old after threats of a school shooting, and he had the guns to get it done. You know me.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our ex-poll question today, should you decide as a voter whether public schools honor transgender or honor the privacy of young women? Well, Let's Go Washington, that's Brian Haywood's outfit, they managed to field six different initiatives, and the public loved those initiatives. I mean, some of them were on parental rights, some were on use of natural gas. It was a whole spread of different issues backed up by Let's Go Washington. Well, they are looking for signatures again. They want an initiative campaign on trans youth sports and parental rights. Should you be able to decide as a voter whether the public schools honor trans or honor the privacy of young women? My answer to that is yes. It should be put to a vote. And I'm willing to bet I know how that vote would come out, and so do the liberals and the Democrats who support trans. They know that this would be bad news for them. They will fight it every step of the way. You can find today's X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go first to Logan. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Pleasure talking with you. Long time.
Nice to talk to you as well. Thank you. Thanks for that.
Hey, I want to just let you know, at least here in Southern Oregon, I think what we have in Oregon, it's even the Republican Party itself is so controlled and corrupted that it's really even grassroots candidates, or I don't know if you've heard about Chael Sonnen throwing his hat, possibly throwing his hat governor. It can't happen with the corruption. And I can speak just from experience here down in Medford, in Southern Oregon, Jackson County here. I ran in the primary last year.
Yeah.
But I was running against the former chief of police of Medford. So within 3 hours of me actually turning in my paperwork down at our county clerk's office, Chris Walker, she's a great lady, guess where I was?
I don't know. Where?
I was in jail.
Why? What was the charge?
Well, they actually used a church. I'm going to be a little bit skeptical.
No, hold on. Logan, if you're going to dodge on this, everybody listening knows why people dodge questions. What was the charge they arrested you for?
The charge was stalking and menacing and disorderly conduct.
Okay. Were you found guilty?
No, they set the trial for 1 week after the election, and then of course the charges were dismissed.
Well, hold on, I'm missing something here. You filed your paperwork to run, which is months before the election, and then you were held in custody until 1 week after the election.
No, I wasn't in custody. I was out campaigning
for the office.
I was. At that point, it was for mayor of Medford.
Okay. And you lost, I'm guessing?
I did. Okay. I did, yes. I was actually, because of the charges. I mean, people don't know.
How many people knew that you'd been charged with stalking and menacing?
The news covered it a couple times.
Okay. Why were you accused of stalking and menacing? What were you doing?
There was a pastor of a church down here, Mountain Christian Fellowship. This gentleman, I guess he's a pastor there no longer. He said that I was going to come shoot up his church.
Did he have a reason for that, to say that?
None whatsoever.
Okay. Did you bring a lawsuit for false arrest? Because if you're arrested on a false basis, you'd have one hell of a lawsuit, I would think.
Hey, Lars. Can I give my number on the air for attorneys?
No, I don't advise people to give their number on the air. That's an extraordinarily bad idea. Logan, thanks for the call. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just saw something over the weekend that got my attention. I don't know. Do you know anything about this Dr. Corsi?
You mean Jerome Corsi? C-O-R-S-I?
Jerome Corsi. I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was something that was reported over the weekend with Stephen Gardner on his website. I guess he's like a news guy. And they were talking about, apparently, they got some goods they're getting ready to drop on the Democrat Party that something to do with them making all their money off children and a bunch of... Did you hear anything about this?
Ron, no. Look, I know I've met Jerome Corsi plenty of times. He's been around for a long time. He's been on the show from time to time. I've been at events where he's been present. But what does all that have to do with what? With anything? You're just asking me if I've heard about the theory? I haven't. But do the Democrats routinely use lies and distortion? Ask a couple of Supreme Court justice nominees. They do. Ask Donald Trump. They used lies and distortion. I mean, the Steele dossier, the FBI, would you find it surprising that the Democrats are going to make up fake information and then try to sell it to the public as legit?
Well, no, that wouldn't surprise me. It just seemed like he was going against the Democrats, so I didn't know if he had credibility with you.
You mean Corsi's generally a conservative. I don't think he identifies with them. Why would it be strange for him to I guess, say things about the Democrats up to their own old shenanigans.
Well, he said something was dropping in the next about 48 hours. And I
okay. Yeah, well, let's wait and see if it drops. Because, Ron, you hear people promise all the time, well, the big thing is coming next week. When? Oh, real soon. Let's wait and see what it is, because I don't, if you've got good information, there's no reason not to put it out right now, but I appreciate the call. Back in a moment. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and congratulations to the state of Idaho that has won a court battle to keep transgender students out of opposite-sex restrooms at state universities. That is just one of the issues where Idaho seems to be knocking it out of the park, and the main guy at bat is the Attorney General of that state, the 33rd Attorney General for Idaho, Raul Labrador, who joins me now. General Labrador, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about what the efforts were to try to stop the effect of House Bill 264, the choice of Idaho representatives, right?
As you know, Idaho House Bill 264 protects student privacy in university restrooms. And we had a group of activists who attempted to prevent us from enforcing the law. And the law ensures that single-person accommodations for anyone unwilling or unable to use multi-occupancy restrooms. And it also ensures that we keep boys out of girls' bathrooms. It's just common sense. You know, listening to your intro about the president that we have and what I think the presidential election was about bringing back common sense to America. And I think we're seeing it in the courtrooms. We're seeing it in the legislatures where people are saying enough is enough. And a federal judge denied the challenger's motion for preliminary injunction and it keeping our law fully enforceable during the litigation.
Hey, by the way, since I'm not a lawyer and most of my audience is not lawyers, thank goodness, is there a way to describe what the opponents of House Bill 264 were arguing about, why they thought that it was somehow, it was out of line to put a limitation, say, boys in the boys' room, girls in the girls' room, or ladies in men's room? What was the argument they were using that was supposed to defeat House Bill 264?
So in all of these lawsuits, what they generally argue is an equal protection type of argument that treating a person of an opposite sex person who wants to enter into a bathroom or enter into sports is violating their equal protection laws. They also look at Title IX, which is one of the laws that we have about equal treatment of females in sports and in other accommodations, and they look at various constitutional analyses where they claim that the person that is being prevented or being blocked from being in those bathrooms or in the sports, for instance, that they're being discriminated against. And the reality is that those laws were all put in place to protect girls and women in their private environments, and they're turning that on their head, trying to allow boys and men to participate in the same activities that girls and women are participating in. And so far, the courts have rejected it. When it comes to bathrooms in Idaho, we also had a similar victory in our K through 12 schools, where a different lawsuit that was brought by the same group of activists, where we were successful in defending. Well,
and in fact, I don't understand how they can apply the equal protection argument. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but most of the equal protections are based on immutable characteristics, black skin, white skin, male gender, female gender, you're a Christian, somebody else is Jewish. those are immutable characteristics, and they're protected as special classes. But the minute they say, but I can decide to be a girl one day and a boy the next day and non-binary the day after that, how is that protected by the laws that protect immutable characteristics?
Well, I think that's what we're finding that the courts are starting to reject. And it's taken a while. It, you know, the last 5 or 6 years of jurisprudence have been very difficult because I think common sense kind of went out the window a little bit. And we saw the courts looking for ways to appease these activist groups and these people who were trying to find protection in the law. One of our main arguments was that the kids and adults who go to college, they have a right of privacy, and they have a right to make sure that they're in their secret and special places, that they have places in their private places, that they have a right to be private in those areas, and they have a right to privacy. So girls, you know, you don't send your kids to school so boys can be in their bathrooms and in their different activities. So it's something that it just doesn't make any sense. I don't think parents liked it. I think most people during the last 4 or 5 years, they were just being shut out and shut down of the conversation, and they were being called bigots and other things. But what we were just trying to do is to protect our girls and our women in their private spaces, and I think the courts are finally agreeing with that.
I'm talking to the Attorney General of the state of Idaho, Raul Labrador. General Labrador, tell me this. There's another issue that you've been championing, and I think people ought to be scared to death of the potential for this. I know there's a lot of complicated language, but you were talking about when people make deep fakes using AI to make it appear as though somebody is usually not clothed, and you fake a picture and then put them in an intimate situation, all of this created by computers, but it really looks like that person perhaps having sex or in some other kind of sexual pose. You want Idaho to get to protect people against that as well, right?
Yeah, we want tech companies to stop enabling the creation and the spread of these deep fake intimate imagery targeting women and girls. And our ICAC unit has been, our Internet Crimes Against Children unit has been fighting this fight. In fact, the Idaho legislature last year passed a law that made it illegal, just as illegal to have a deep fake images on your computer as it is to have actual images. You know, I'm not going to bore you with all the information, but the reality is that in order to make an AI image of a child, you have to look, the computer looks at hundreds, if not thousands, of real images online. So these poor children are being violated again and again and again, and their privacy is being violated, and the images are being used and reused and reused. So when you look at something that is deep fake, it is based on something that is real, that is out there. And having the deep fake is just as pernicious and just as bad as it is having the actual image. So in fact, this year we just had our first prosecution of somebody who had only deep fake images, and they thought that they were okay because they're not, you know, quote unquote real pictures, but they are real pictures. They're created by culling hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of real pictures online.
And in fact, just to put a shot across their bow, if you do that kind of thing, even if you say this is 100% fake, there's enough basis in reality that they will be prosecuted for the crime of, say, creating child pornography, right?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. Attorney General Labrador, thank you very much. That is the 33rd Attorney General for the state of Idaho, and I think those are common sense changes. Keep the boys in the boys' room, the girls in the girls' room, and stay out of child pornography, even the stuff that is 100% fake. It is still illegal, and I want people protected against it. Can you imagine your daughter or granddaughter being depicted in this way, and then once those images are online, they're almost impossible to remove? Even if they're 100% fake, if it appears to be your family member, what do you do then? You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
I just give my love and hope to the family of the young woman who was stabbed this morning or last night in Charlotte by a madman, a lunatic, just got up and started. It's right on the tape. Not really watchable because it's so horrible. But just viciously stabbed. She's just sitting there. So they're evil people. We have to be able to handle that. If we don't handle that, we don't have a country.
That is Donald Trump, of course, speaking about something horrible that happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. And my question is, how could America's national news media for 10 days ignore such a horrific crime? Now, if you say, well, the national news media doesn't always cover stabbings or other assaults that happen at the local level, I'd ask you to remember the case of Daniel Penny. You remember Daniel Penny, the former Marine riding a New York subway train? A crazy homeless man began engaging in assaultive and threatening behavior. He decided to subdue the man. The man ended up dying. Boy, the media couldn't get enough of that. And in fact, I know you're going to say, but it happened in New York City. Well, if the national news media claims to be national news media, then it shouldn't matter if it happens in New York City or Charlotte, North Carolina. So what happened in Charlotte, North Carolina about 10 days ago that caught President Trump's attention? A 23-year-old woman, she was riding a light rail train in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the video from that train shows her come into the train, sit down. She is sitting one seat in front of a man. The man turns out to be, and I'll tell you who he was, DeCarlos Brown Jr., 34 years old, and apparently something of a, you know, a career criminal, because he had had lots and lots of interaction with the police, and apparently he may have had mental problems as well. But she just sits down in front of this man. She's wearing a baseball cap. She's looking at her phone. I don't know if she's reading a book or reading her email or reading text messages. Her name is Irina Zarudska. Irina Zarudska is sitting there, 23 years old, doing nothing, having no interaction with the man behind her. Not a good interaction, not a bad interaction, just sitting on a train in front of this other guy. What does he do? 4 minutes after she sat down in that seat, he pulls a pocket knife out of his pocket, and on video, he stabs her three times. She bleeds out on the train. So this is a 23-year-old woman who lost her life simply because she happened to be sitting on public transit in front of, as the president described him, a madman. Now, guess what happened since? In the last 10 days, today, some of the national news media started to take notice of this, but up to yesterday, zero Associated Press stories, zero PBS, zero New York Times, zero NPR, zero Wall Street Journal, BBC, CNN, WAPO, Reuters, MSNBC, most of the cartel media ignored the story 100%. Now, let me throw in one factor. The man who did the attacking, he's in custody and he's charged with the crime, was black, or is black. And the young woman who lost her life, white. And I have a feeling the major cartel media ignores this altogether. Well, the reaction now is coming out. Brendan Jones, the majority leader of the North Carolina House, he said the tragedy of Irina Zarudska's death in Charlotte is a result of Democrat DAs and sheriffs putting their woke agendas above the public. Violent criminals commit crimes with impunity. Families live in fear. And let me give you a list of the things that have been done. You may find them familiar depending on where you live in America. Here's what's happened. Charlotte City Council 5 years ago said, we're going to reimagine policing. I hear this kind of language all the time. They wanted to divert 911 calls away from the police department. And why? Because invariably, if the police show up and there's criminal activity, somebody gets busted. If they send a social worker instead, then oftentimes people don't get busted for the crimes they commit. Now, imagine what happens when you tell the criminal class, you can do these things and nothing's going to happen except a visit from a social worker. And then about 5 years ago, again, Governor Roy Cooper established the Task Force for Racial Equity in Criminal Justice, playing the race card, co-chaired by the then Attorney General and the current governor, Josh Stein, which recommended reimagining public safety to promote diversion and other alternatives to arrest. In other words, keeping the bad guys out of jail, de-emphasizing, as they put it, felony crimes, prioritizing restorative justice, which is such a big joke. You know what the typical case of restorative justice is? You get the rape victim to sit down face to face with the rapist And then the rapist explains to the victim why he did what he did and how very sorry he is. And the rape victim has to sit there and listen to this garbage. And then what did they do? Over the last 7 years, in the county where this happened, they got millions of dollars from a foundation that advocates for no cash bail, decreasing jail populations to, as they put it, address inequities. In other words, engage in race-based justice. So what ends up happening? This guy has had interaction after interaction with the police. Nothing much was done about him. And then when he allegedly murders a young woman, what happens? Well, they just say, well, we're sorry he did that. In 2020, the Charlotte Mecklenburg police chief, Johnny Jennings, said law enforcement in general is based on racism. That's coming from the local police chief, and their department should probably slow down on what they call discretionary advice, arrests. In 2020, Democrat State Senator Mujibita Mohammed, who represents Charlotte, declared independence from the rogue police. What they're doing is they're letting criminals go. And when they do that, horrible crimes like this happen, and the end result is innocent people end up dead. As Mike Marinella put it, Democrats coddle criminals and abandon victims, and now an innocent young woman is dead because of it. No amount of spin can wash away their radical soft-on-crime record. The bottom line of all of this is that Democrats in public office are letting criminals get away with anything they want to get away with. Fact is, this man did his alleged crime on camera, and this young woman is dead. And the result, well, the result could be changed. What we should be doing is saying when you break the law, no matter what color you are, then you will be arrested and you will be prosecuted and you will end up with justice. They're not wanting to do that. They say, but when we make those arrests, we arrest a disproportionate number of black Americans. Too bad. 50% of the homicides in America are committed by black suspects and black killers, and 90% of their victims are people of color. Factor that in, too. Let's go to your phones. Scott, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me. I just had a quick question about ODOT and the 40 cents a gallon. That's just the tax on the gas, not to mention the PUCs and all of that. Where do you go to find out how much money they're taking in from all this? Because there's a couple service stations over in Medford, big stores, and you can sit there and they're just pumping gas, and it's just one store. I just feel like they're making a lot of money. And
they are making. In fact, Scott, I'll give you the handiest number without just giving you a meaningless number of hundreds of millions. But last year, 2024, while ODOT is claiming that they've seen decreased gas tax revenues, in 2024, the state of Oregon collected more gas taxes in that year than it had in any year before. It was a historic high. Now, the truth is, it's not as high as they'd want it to be, but they collected more money from the gas tax last year than they ever have in a single year in Oregon history. And the fact is, they want to divert a lot of that money to transit, to light rail trains, to bike paths, to bicycle paths, and everything else. They don't want to spend the money on the roads, and the end result is citizens get ripped off. Scott, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I wouldn't impress anyone if I said, well, Joe Biden was kind of checked out during his entire presidency. In fact, there were Democrats who saw that with their own eyes in the fall of 2021. In other words, just 8 or 9 months into his presidency, they could see that he wasn't exactly firing on all cylinders. But after Joe Biden's presidency, I think people have kind of forgotten about the issue to a large extent, but not Susan Ferriccio, who is national politics correspondent for The Washington Times, because I want to talk about pardons and some of the documents that Joe Biden allegedly signed, except now it's becoming clearer he didn't even have his eyes on most of them. Susan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell me about this story you've written for WA Times that says that Joe Biden was actually checked out on all of this, that there were pardons going left and right, thousands of them, and that his own staff was trying to scramble because they couldn't show that the president actually knew anything about them.
Well, Biden pardoned or provided clemency to more individuals than any president in history. And what's really notable about his pardons is that he didn't sign each and every one of them. They were all combined, most of them, at the last minute under three different clemency warrants. And Biden did not sign any of those documents. So he didn't sign the individual pardons, and he didn't sign the clemency warrants that the pardons were issued under. Instead, his staff put these pardons together and consulted with Biden over it allegedly. But then later, according to documents that were obtained from the National Archives, they worked to create a paper trail to ensure that they have in writing that Biden gave the go-ahead for these. And they looked to be creating that so that it would appear that he was more involved than he actually was. So a lot of this conversation took place over email, very late in Biden's term, just a few days before the end of his term. And these were late-night emails going back and forth between top aides. And what we saw by looking at these documents is a picture of aides trying to make it look like Biden was really more fully involved in this than he actually was. And then if you compare who ended up on this pardon list, you have, you know, a lot of drug offenders, obviously, but there were people who were also had committed violent crimes or more serious crimes than just the drug offenses. So it's appeared to go beyond what President Biden had publicly said he intended for these pardons, which was supposed to really just address a discrepancy in drug sentencing that Biden had made note of, having to do with cocaine versus crack convictions. So, and the overall picture you get from looking at these documents is that the staff were bum rushing these pardons through for thousands of criminals, quite a few of whom were not just simple drug offenders. In fact, I wrote a story earlier this summer, just a couple weeks ago, about how the one of the deputy attorney generals in Biden's Justice Department wrote to the White House advising that the way these pardons were worded was so vague that they were likely to sweep in people that the president had not intended to pardon, and that these were not simply nonviolent offenders, that these definitely included some people who you wouldn't have thought Biden would want to pardon. So it was being flagged by the Justice Department, by Biden's own Justice Department, but the White House went ahead with this anyway. And what we know now is that the president has, former president, has commented publicly, and we can look at what he said and then look who has been pardoned. So if you listen to what Biden said, he gave a 7-minute interview to the New York Times a couple weeks ago about this. And he said, you know, he gave parameters for who should be pardoned, but he didn't approve of each and every one. My observation is that if you look at each and every one, they don't fit those parameters of what the president wanted. And to me, that's just evidence that he was checked out, that other people were governing for him. And in fact, some of the documents, at least one, indicates that the decision-making was delegated to VP Harris, the vice president at the time. Now, as far as I know, the vice president does not have pardon authority. I don't think that anyone would think that.
Nope.
That only Biden does. And so you can even say, people make the argument, well, look, Biden doesn't even have to sign a pardon. There's nothing in the Constitution that says, you know, he can pardon anybody he wants. I think that what I'm seeing in these documents is that Biden may not have intended for these pardons. Now, he's saying now that he did. But if you look at who he had intended to pardon by what he has said, and then you look at the list of people pardoned and the volume of people pardoned, and it really raises questions about what his intent was and what was carried out without his active participation. And I think it's a really important conversation to have.
I'm talking to Susan Ferriccio, who's national politics correspondent. You know, Susan, one of my favorite Latin phrases the lawyers like to use is mens rea. It means the guilty mind. It means when you see somebody doing something and the only reason they're doing it is because they know that what they're doing is wrong, then that's evidence of mens rea. And it sounds like a lot of these DOJ types and the White House staffers that were doing this cleanup work realized that what they were doing is wrong, that it didn't have any kind of connection back to Biden, and they were trying to do something so they could say, well, there's a paper trail. It shows that he actually made the decision. Was that your impression as well?
What I see is that they understood that what they were doing was big and unprecedented. They know the person in charge of the auto pen, that's the mechanical signature that signed a lot of things for President Biden. They knew that they were doing an awful lot of auto penning. and that's clear from how they discussed these pardons. And they also knew they were pardoning an historic number of people. Thousands of people they pardoned in last minute pardons. They're felons. Of course, we know that there were also pardons involving politicians, Biden's family members and others. But the mass pardoning of these drug convictions that also included killers, people committed violent assaults, drug traffickers, it signals that this was a really big thing they were trying to do. And I don't think they quite got it right, because they didn't just get the people, either that or maybe this was right for them. They wanted to get these people through and it didn't matter to them. Whereas it probably would have mattered. Think about Joe Biden, you know, and those of us who covered him, those reporters who have known him for a long time. He was always this tough on crime senator on Capitol Hill. He helped push through one of the biggest crime reform bills under the Clinton administration. So he certainly is somebody who has been tough minded on crime. And to see this list of people pardoned, knowing that how Biden's traditional stance on things, even though he has moved left, we know that, you know, it doesn't make sense. And
so what was driving it? Do you get a sense?
That's the question
because
I have.
If it wasn't the president doing it and it wasn't his staff, were they doing favors for someone? Or, I mean, was there some other incentive? Otherwise, why pardon all these people?
The belief is that, you know, there were a lot of outside groups that were influencing who was going to get a pardon. Of course, when it comes to pardon, there's all kinds of lobbying going on. That's been the way it's historically done. But in this instance, there were a lot of outside groups pressuring for pardons of certain individuals. Some of them are just real head scratchers. One of the individuals who now walks free is a man convicted of killing a witness and her daughter, young daughter. They were going to testify against him in a drug trial. He's out free. There are others who are on the list for food just recently for assaulting federal officers.
Wow. Susan Ferriccio's story can be found at the Washington Times. Susan, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Back in a moment, we'll get to your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. And what happens when labor unions go out and hit the streets to recruit new members, but they're losing?
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails on a Monday. I was kind of getting a kick out of an email exchange I had. I have a lot of them with listeners. I get about 1,000 emails a day. I managed to answer most of them very quickly. And I mentioned that there are a number of giant hydrogen projects that are simply having the plug pulled on them, pun intended, because they don't make economic sense. And all of a sudden, the money from the Green New Deal, you know, the Joe Biden Inflation Reduction Act and all the other garbage that he shoveled in, where he was giving out billions of dollars to incentivize people to do things like hydrogen as an energy source. Hydrogen is an energy carrier. It is not a source. Think of it this way. If you're out of gasoline and I hand you an empty 5-gallon gas can, you say, this is great when I get some gasoline, but I have to have the gasoline in the can. The empty can doesn't do anything. Hydrogen carries energy, but you have to make it. and it takes energy to make the hydrogen. You have to split, and people say, no, it's simple, Lars, you make it out of water. Yes, you split water, H2O, into H and two oxygens, but you have to put energy in. You either have to put in heat energy, electric energy. You can take natural gas and break it down into hydrogen. I'm glad to see that all these projects are getting trashed right now because they don't make economic sense. And the very fact that the minute the Biden money went away, meaning your federal tax dollars went away, and this gentleman, Doug, wrote to me and he said, Lars, I heard you on the radio talking about hydrogen. You failed to mention one other method. And I said, well, what is the method? I said, because I mentioned electrolysis. Well, he mentions electrolysis, too. And he said, this technology has existed for many years. Actually, it's existed, I think, for more than a century. It uses electrolysis to separate hydrogen and oxygen. I got to tell you something, folks. All the people who get excited about hydrogen, you have to understand one basic phenomenon, and that is, if you take electrolysis to split hydrogen into water into hydrogen and oxygen, for every kilowatt hour you put in electricity, you get about 3/4 of a kilowatt hour worth of hydrogen. That would be like somebody handing you $10 bills. You hand them back $7.50. It's that kind of economic deal. He says it's a small kit that can be built and installed under your car hood. Use your search engine. Well, this is getting excited about technology. There really isn't technology because there are people who believe you, if you add a little bit of hydrogen into your gasoline mix, probably not the best idea to be producing hydrogen under the hood of your car with all the electrical ignition circuits, but it doesn't produce any net energy. It is a net energy loser, and we have enough net energy losers out there. So just a suggestion, if you want to study hydrogen, it's an interesting technology for, say, saving energy. But remember, it costs a lot of money. And when you're done with it, you can store 10 kilowatt hours of electricity as long as you're not unhappy when what you get back is 7.5 kilowatt hours of electricity. And that's about as efficient as that process gets. If they, even if they got it to 0.999 efficiency, you're still losing in the process, and it's still costing you a lot of money. And all it does is allow you to store some of the energy for a time. Let's go to Courtney. Hey, Courtney, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
I'm just curious when Trump is going to come to the small towns. I live in a small town in Oregon. And I was just wondering when he's going to come to the small towns that are overridden with illegal immigrants.
I'm sure it's going to happen. But, Courtney, I think what the president's trying to do is hit the biggest targets, grab the low-hanging fruit. I mean, there are so many illegal aliens in the country. Before Joe Biden's invasion that he sponsored for 4 years, we had an estimated 20 to 30 million illegals in America. Then Joe added somewhere around another 10 million. So it's going to take a while. And if the places they focus on first are the biggest population centers like Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, all of which are sanctuary cities, they're probably going to focus there rather than in small towns. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. But you do believe that it will happen at some point in time?
I think what's going to happen, rather, Courtney, is Trump has sent the message, you're not welcome here unless you're here legally. And they're arresting a lot of people. By the end of the year, they probably will have deported about a million, and they probably will have had self-deportations of about another million. Plus, the southern border is closed up as tight as it ever has been in modern American history. So where you had literally about 2 million, 2.5 million illegals coming in every year across Joe Biden's border, you have essentially zero coming across. It's like if you have a leak in the house or in your roof, you want to close the leak first, right? You've got pots and pans under the drips inside, and you need to deal with that too. But you got to close that hole first. Trump has closed that hole. Now ICE and CBP are arresting the illegals. And a lot of illegals are starting to self-deport because they're saying, we now understand there's going to be a consequence if we stay here. And one of the downsides is if somebody came in illegally and they plan to stay here, if they get kicked out, if they get deported, it works against them if they ever try to come back legally. And there used to be people who just went back and forth across the border without any consequence at all. They found out now if you leave, you're not coming back unless you come back legally. So he's closed the leak, the hole in the roof, and he's now cleaning up all those pots and pans and buckets that are catching the drips inside, and he's going to the places where the greatest number of illegal aliens are, and that's the major sanctuary population centers. So will those other illegals eventually leave on their own or be deported? Yes, they will. Is it all going to happen in the next couple of years? Probably not. Courtney, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And from time to time, we see teachers go on strike. They never seem to get as much as they want to get. And their labor unions are pretty unforgiving. What they typically do is they go on strike during the school year. I've had people ask, why don't they go on strike during the summer? Because that doesn't hurt the children during the summer, and it doesn't hurt the parents and the taxpayers during the summer. So the unions do what they do because they know they can hold a gun to people's heads, at least metaphorically, and say, pay us more money or your kids get hurt. Now, to me, that is nothing but extortion. But now, school district negotiations happen behind closed doors while the families are scrambling to try to find childcare. Should taxpayers get a chance to see how their education dollars are being negotiated by the folks they've elected to the school board? Elizabeth New joins me now, who's a research analyst and director of the Center for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. Hey, Elizabeth, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lars. Yeah, strikes are looking very contagious down here.
Well, is there any good reason to keep the public out of this? I've complained endlessly saying, look, you've got a contract that's being made between effectively the public and, you know, the taxpayers and the teachers union. And yet the public has its representatives, the school board, and the public is supposed to simply be kept in the dark until they're told what the bill is going to be. Seems to me that the folks writing the check, meaning the taxpayers, ought to be in on the negotiations. And I think there's a reason that the school boards and the unions keep it secret, because they don't want the public's input.
I agree. You know, public bargaining should be open to the public. Not only are these taxpayer dollars we're talking about, you know, we don't know if the union claims that the contract offered is unfair or the district's claims that the offers are generous. Are or are not. Sometimes union members, well, often union members don't even know. You know, I'm taking email from people and things that say, this misrepresents the issue and the contracts aren't fair, but we can't even see them. We don't even know what's going on. These are private negotiations, and they can't tell me what is being deemed unfair or not unfair.
No, and in fact, if you think about it this way, if the union comes in and says, look, we've asked for an offer, they gave us an offer, it stinks. Okay, then tell the public. Except I think they're afraid that when the public sees the percentage increase or the dollar increase that's being offered, the public's going to say, no, that's more than sufficient. That's what you should offer. I think the union is afraid if the public could actually see what is being offered, they'd say, you guys ought to get off the strike line. That's a perfectly reasonable offer. Except we're only told what the dollar amount is or the percentage increase after the strike is over, when it's too late to do anything about it.
Absolutely. It's just totally bizarre. You know, parents and family members of students are having to figure out what to do, since a promised state service that they build their own lives around is not being provided. You know, I'm always hopeful, recognizing students and families' financial hardship, in addition to the learning loss for students, will keep school employees from striking. But it doesn't. And, you know, I'm glad to see that this week childcare is being made available in the Evergreen public schools, various school sites. But families have to pay for the care. $60 a day there. I think YMCA is also offering strike care for kids at about $40 for their day's offering. And, you know, I think unions calling for strike should be paying for these child care days, not the parents.
I think so, too. But I wish that at this point, child care may be the most significant thing that schools do. Because when it comes to actual right. learning, whether or not the kids are getting up to the approved level of reading, writing, and math, about half the kids do and about half the kids don't. Nationwide, it's even lower than that on the success side of things. So when school becomes just a glorified daycare, then we're paying way too much for it. But I think you're right that if the unions had to admit to the public this is what's being offered, they would simply go a different direction. Is there any good reason why the school boards, who are supposed to represent the public and the taxpayers and the parents, a lot of school boards seem to think they only represent the parents and the students. They don't. About 80% of us don't have kids in public school right now, but we pay the taxes to get good public schooling. And then they say, oh, we're only representing the parents. No, you're not. You're representing everybody who's paying the tab and everybody for whom public schooling is consequential. Why don't the school boards offer up this information? Say, this is what we offered them. This is what they turned down.
Well, I talked to the communications director at EPS today, and I was asking that question. And, you know, the reality is they're having to release some information about what is being offered when they're talking about these things, and they've pointed it out. But I think both sides like the quiet because of the social media engagement that can happen around it. And, you know, look, schools are full of a lot of hardworking people. They don't want these teachers and staff workers to lose reputation in the public's eye either. And if we did know what they're calling unfair when their cost of living increased allotments are higher than most of ours anywhere else, they're not going to be looked at favorably. And I think that hurts the school district as much as it hurts the unions. I still think they should be public. It's taxpayer money, and we need to know what's fair or unfair.
Well, not only that, but Elizabeth, try this on for size. You and I both looked at school district contracts. You have a contract to teach 180 days a year. For most people work 250 days a year. Some people work more. 180 sounds like a vacation. And then you say, well, how many hours of those 180 do you actually have to work? 5.5 hours. Some of the contracts say 5 hours and 15 minutes of actual teaching every day. And you say, hold on a second, you work half the year, 180 days, less than half of a year, and then you actually have to teach 5 hours and 15 minutes, and you get all the major holidays and the whole summer off. That sounds like a very sweet deal. What are you complaining about?
You know, in the center, it's educators who are striking. In Evergreen and potentially in Vancouver, if they vote down their offer this week, our support staff, they're doing this. Now, support staff, it should also be pointed out, these are part-time workers, a lot of them. There are some full-timers in there, but most of them are part-time workers who get generous pay and benefits from the school district for 180 days of work that they'll still get once they rearrange the calendar to accommodate the strike, and they get 10 paid holidays. So when you hear them saying we need a living wage, most of us don't take a part-time job to expect a living wage.
Nope.
And that's what's present here.
Yeah, and the fact is that practice should stop. The one where you say you went on strike for 10 days or 20 days or whatever it was, and now we're going to go back and pay you for all the days you didn't work. I wish one school board would just stake that out and say, we're not paying you if you were not working. If you were not working by your own choice because you went on strike, you don't get paid for those days. The kids lost, and they don't get compensated for that. That's Elizabeth New, who's director of the Center for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LawrenceLarson.com. And coming up on the Radio Northwest Network, the Postal Service changes the definition of what a postmark means. arrive days after the end of counting. And in various different states, they're adopting various different rules, saying, well, you can count the ballots up to a week. I think in some cases up to 10 days if they arrive at the elections headquarters after that. Now, here's what the USPS says. While the presence of a postmark on a mail confirms that the Postal Service was in possession of the mail piece on the date of the postmark, the postmark does not inherently or necessarily align with the date on which USPS first accepted possession of the mail piece. I know it's complicated and bureaucratic. What they're saying is, yeah, we put a date on it. That date must have come after we came into possession of that piece of mail, but we may have had that piece of mail in our hands for days. I don't know if it would necessarily go to weeks. Voters can confirm the exact date that the Postal Service first accepted possession, but here's what you have to do. You can hand the ballot or mail to a postal clerk at the post office, not at the elections headquarters, and request a manual postmark. You can also buy, get this, you have to spend more money. You have to buy a certificate of mailing or pay extra for registered or certified mail. So the Postal Service is saying, we're going to tell voters, if you want to cast that ballot and you want to make sure there's a date on it that shows when it came into the Postal Service system, you're going to have to either pay more money or drive down to a post office during operating hours. Remember, they're a government agency. They aren't open all the time, and say, I want to have a manual postmark. USPS makes a distinction between the postmark and what they are calling the first accepted possession of a piece of mail. It's like they hired too many lawyers at the Postal Service. The postmark only confirms that the Postal Service had possession of the piece of mail on that date, not that it received the mail on that date. So they could have received it and then days later marked it as saying it's now in our system. They say this proposal is necessitated by the implementation of the USPS mail stream restructuring called Delivering for America that was introduced in 2021. Under the system, a piece of mail may have entered the stream several days before the postmark is applied. All mail is now processed at regional facilities. The postmark is applied by machines, not at the local post office. That means mail could be held at a local post office for a number of days. How many? They don't say. The delay is exacerbated by weekends, holidays, and rural areas that are a long way away from the regional postal facility. So, can you imagine what this is going to do to vote by mail? They're effectively saying, we can't tell you when we actually took that piece of mail, if it's a ballot, into our possession. We can just tell you that it was in our possession when we put the mark on it. Maybe we got it a few days earlier. Well, President Trump says he doesn't like the vulnerabilities in vote by mail, and he recognizes the potential for election fraud. So he issued an executive order to address that and made comments saying he wants to eliminate vote by mail altogether. I would like to eliminate vote by mail as well. It is too subject to fraud. And in fact, one of the people who came to that conclusion after a presidential commission years ago was President Jimmy Carter. He headed up that commission. He was one of the two heads of that commission. And he said the biggest opportunities for fraud in our voting system are in vote by mail. Now, if the Democrats admit it, well, maybe we should get rid of it and go back to voting at the polls. Let's go to Daryl, who's a naysayer on the subject of teachers. Daryl, we're close to the break. What's on your mind and what do you and I disagree about?
Well, I'm a retired teacher. I taught public, private school. I taught social studies, and I taught a lot of CTE courses. And I want to ask you, are you a part-time worker?
No.
Oh, wait a minute. You're only on the radio a few hours a day.
Yes.
That's 6 hours a day. Teacher.
No, it's not. Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Have you ever been a teacher?
No, and I don't need to be. I don't need to be a cop to talk about cops. Well, I don't need to be an astronaut to talk about astronauts. Let's get past that. But, Daryl, Let me ask you a question. If you teach American history this year, are you going to teach it pretty much the same way next year?
Yeah, it's a different group of kids. I always have to tailor it to the kids.
Oh, hold on. You mean the class changes and American history changes too? Wow. I'd never heard of that concept.
Yeah, you have to tailor your classes to your kids.
So if it, how do the kids have to change if most of the kids are girls or boys, does that change American history?
The way you teach it changes.
Why?
You have to communicate with them differently.
Ah. Daryl, thank you for the call. Good naysayer.
The Lars Larson Show. He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. You know, one of the things I like about some of the federal laws is they say that insider trading is not allowed. That means if you happen to work inside of a company and you know things the company is doing, that you're not allowed to go out and make either a decision to sell stock or to buy stock, because that would give you an unnatural advantage. And yet I wasn't aware of something that our friend Steve Moore has made me aware of. Steve is an economist and co-founder of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity and a former Donald Trump economic advisor. Apparently Wall Street has a bunch of exclusive investments that are not available to all, Steve. That seems out of line, doesn't it?
Hi, Lars. Great to be with you. Well, there's good news to this story, actually. So for many, many years, investment in like real estate investment trusts and high performing private equity funds and so on were not available to people with 401k plans. You just had to invest in regular stocks and bonds, which is fine. But that denied people the opportunity to get into investments that can give you very high returns. Now, with higher returns, you always have a little bit higher risk. But so for many years, retirement funds were not regulatory permitted to invest in these things. Donald Trump has signed a new executive order saying if people want to, and this would be voluntary, with your 401k plans, you can put some of your money into these higher return investments. Over time, they bring in about a 2% higher annual rate of return over a 30-year, 40-year working period. That means a lot more money. That's tens of thousands of dollars more that people will be able to earn if they choose to do it.
In fact, the thing called private equity, and Steve, if I understand private equity the right way, it means when you go out and say, let's buy that company, we think that company is going places, we think we can buy it now, sell it in a decade or sell it in 5 years, it'll be worth this much more, and they make a lot more money. There is more risk, as you said, but it's a lot more lucrative. So you could put a small percentage of your 401k into those high-risk investments. Why are they locked? Why do they lock out most of the rest of us?
Well, they've locked them out because the federal government said, well, those are too risky. Now, again, they are riskier, but the return based on the risk tends to be higher. And incidentally, many of these small and medium-sized firms eventually will go public. And so the best kind of investment you can make is to invest in a company before it goes public, because then its price goes up as shareholders allowed to buy the stock in it. So this is a good deal for Americans. You know, we need to have a share of the wealth. You know, liberals always complain, oh, only the wealthy people share, you know, have the wealth. That's because there's so many rules that prevent people from expanding their wealth. And this is something that will, I like the Trump's idea of giving every child at birth $1,000 that could be invested in the market. By the time you turn 25 or 30, you're going to have a lot of money in that account.
Well, in fact, Steve, let me ask you something else. There is a little twist to the 401k. If I put, and I do put money in my 401k every year, I put that in without paying taxes, but I'll pay taxes on the money when I take it back out. And I'm required to take a certain amount out at certain times. I can't remember what the term is. But if I put a $100 asset in my 401k, and I'm only allowed to put so much in every year, but that $100 asset becomes a $1,000 asset while it's sitting there in the 401k, I don't pay taxes on that either, do I?
Yeah, and that's why 401ks are really good investment opportunities, because they're tax-free savings. And we just, you know, my wife and I just converted a lot of our income into 401k, and our tax bill went way down this year. Because I had a pretty good year economically, you know, financially, and I would have had to pay an enormous, you know, tax bill. And so by putting this money into the 401k, I avoid paying. Now, you know, I'll have to pay money on the, you know, on when I cash out on those. But, you know, hopefully that won't be for another 20, 25 years, God willing. So that's the reason why 401ks are really good. You know, people should put money in 401ks. There's an old saying by Albert Einstein, and the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest. And, you know, that's why young people listen to your show. If you're in your 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, invest now, and the amount of money you're going to have by the time you retire is going to multiply dramatically.
Well, in fact, Steve, one of the things I've encouraged young people I run into, I said, go online and get one of their retirement calculators. And say, okay, I plan to start out putting $100 a paycheck, $200 a month away. And then as my income grows, they ask you to estimate how much do you think your income's going to grow every year. And you could put in some estimates and how much risk you're willing to tolerate. I said, look where you are if you start at 20, where you are at 45. And they say, wow, I got $1 million in there. I said, yep, and $1 million might earn you $50,000 or $60,000 a year for the rest of time if you never touch
exactly
the principal.
Right.
It's got a tremendous power. Were average Americans locked out? And I suspect one of two reasons. One, the very wealthy people want to have this all to themselves. I don't think that's the right theory. Or number two, the government acting like a nanny saying, Mars, you can't do that.
Yes.
It's too risky and you're too stupid to make those kind of investments and weigh risk versus benefit. Do you think it was the latter or the former?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, for some reason, liberals, my liberal friends, they hate defined contribution plans. So a 401k is a defined contribution. You put the money in, and then you get the benefit that you earn, you know, based on the investment you make. So the liberals don't like defined. They want defined benefit where they just, you know, you're going to be insured some certain amount. But defined benefit plans get much lower returns than defined contribution plans. Incidentally, I just turned 65, Lars. You and I have known each other a long time.
We have.
And I just calculated if I had been able to put 10% of my paycheck into a 401k type of plan rather than send it into Social Security, instead of getting $3,000 a month, I'd be getting $10,000 a month.
Wow. Well, I keep telling people, which one is it, Peru or Chile? I think it was Chile. That said,
you can
jump out of the government-sponsored plan, which is basically Chile's version of Social Security, or you can stay in the plan. 5% stayed in the government plan. The other 95% jumped out, and they're all living comfortably now.
Exactly. Well, let's give people choice. By the way, with that 401k plan, if you don't want to invest in PE and, you know, or a real estate trust, you don't have to. We're just giving people that option.
You could put it in gold if you'd done it 2 years ago. I think gold was selling about 2,000 an ounce.
Now it's been up a lot, hasn't it?
Headed for
it's now. I think $3,600 today. That's a pretty big increase. But that's not a good sign, by the way. And when the gold price is rising, that's a negative sign for the economy because it means that people are worried about inflation.
Yeah, and that's the scary thing. But it would be nice to see them. Now, let me ask you something else. Since I got your ear right now. China was forgiven from all the reporting requirements that every other company on earth has to do to be in our capital markets. Is Trump going to fix that and tell China, if you want to be in our capital markets, you have to follow that? Because every American company has to give all this data every quarter, every foreign company that wants to be. But China was forgiven by Obama. Can we take that back and say, hey, China, you want to be in our markets? You got to report just like everybody else. Can we get that
done? It's a great idea, Lars. I'm going to, next time I visit with the president, I'll mention that. I mean, you know, he's very suspicious of China, as we all should be. They're the new evil empire. Why should they be getting special advantages?
Yeah, because I remember I used to work for a company called Chriscraft that used to own airplane companies and boat companies, and they own TV stations. And I get their annual report. It had all kinds of stuff in it. They'd say, well, we've got a possible liability because of a cleanup at a plant site we've owned for decades and all this. You had to know all that. These Chinese companies get to do business and sell their stock in our country and raise trillions of dollars, and yet they're not held to the same requirement. You say, Why is Toyota held to that, or Nissan, or BMW, or any of these companies? And all the American companies have to do it, Microsoft and Boeing and Intel and all those. And then we let the Chi-Coms off the hook because Joe Biden and Barack Obama were best buddies with the Chinese communists. I don't think that's a good reason. That is Steve Moore, co-founder of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. and a former Donald Trump economic advisor. Steve, it's always a pleasure. Back in a moment, I'll get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. With
unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Barry writes in, Lars, I was talking about postmarks and the Postal Service, and they now say, yeah, the fact that it's postmarked on a given day, we may have had that in our hands for days. At this point, because the Postal Service has adopted a new sorting system that goes to regional sorting systems, which means the postmark does not mean that was the day the post office got it, and that's going to pose a problem for vote by mail. Well, Barry writes in from Eugene, usually the postmarks are so faint they can't be read anyway. I guess the post office is running short on ink. Oh, no, they've got red ink to beat the band. It's absolutely amazing. To your calls now. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line. Crystal's on the line. Hey, Crystal, welcome to the program. What's up?
Hey, I just want to say I have a compliment and I have a comment. So the compliment is we just got your show here in town on the radio station, and I just love it. I learn so much every day. And then
you.
My comment is about the post office.
Yeah.
I just do not understand why this has to be so complicated, because the Publishers Clearinghouse started in 1967, and if you don't get your entry in time, you don't win. It's just that simple. And
yep.
So then when you talk about all the other stuff that's happened with the elections and things like that, the problem is not access. It's value. We're not putting enough value on the vote. When Trump won in 2016, he won because people showed up in droves, and they even
yep.
stayed late, and the lines were so long they had to keep the polls open. Same thing happened last year. Everybody showed up, but what happened in 2020 is not enough people showed up. The churches were kind of iffy on, you know, if he was the right guy and all this kind of stuff. So really, it's about value. It's not about access.
Well, except, Crystal, can I add one more thing? And you may not agree with me.
Sure.
That's okay. But I believe that in 2020, there was cheating that went on. And
oh,
I think
was.
A lot of it had to do with vote by mail. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have now, since then, we have learned that there are illegal aliens who are registered to vote throughout America. And there are non-citizen but legal aliens, so green card holders and the like, who are registered to vote throughout America. We know that in a lot of places, for example, Judicial Watch has filed lawsuits against a number of places. Los Angeles County was one of them, where they said you have about 1 million voters on your rolls who don't exist. Now, some of them have died. Some of them have moved. Some of them may never have existed at all. And they finally got the courts to tell L.A. County, you've got to knock 1 million registrations off the list. And then I'd ask you this. If you've got 1 million extra people in a vote by mail environment, and so 1 million ballots are going out to someone. Now, do we know who those ballots are going to? Well, they've got a name and an address on them, but do you actually know who received it? No, you don't. And when somebody marks that ballot and sends it back in, do you know who marked it and who sent it back? And you don't. And so when you have that kind of, and they'll say, well, that's just small stuff. That doesn't really amount to anything. 1 million voters in L.A. County, and then you go throughout the entire country, and oftentimes they'll say, well, it's maybe 2 or 3%. An awful lot of presidential elections are decided on 2 or 3%
yeah.
or less. And so why don't we have a system? And it's amazing to me to watch other countries where they have in-person voting at the polls with ID. You're handed a ballot. You mark the ballot. Your name is marked off on the book. You don't get to vote again. Now, if you have that kind of system, can you still cheat? And assist, yeah, but it's really hard, because if you have poll workers, many times they're volunteers or they do this every time an election comes around, and you've got 2 or 3 poll workers there. Imagine somebody walks in, votes, and then a few hours later, that same person walks back in, says, I want to vote again. They'll say, well, are you marked off in the poll? Yeah, you're marked off, so you can't vote again. It would require a conspiracy of several people to get a few extra votes in. But with vote by mail, They have, since 2020, caught operations in almost every state in America where they're putting together false registrations. And you say, well, what good is a false registration? Well, it's real good if you put Mickey Mouse on there at such and such an address, and you know that a ballot is coming to Mickey Mouse's address. And literally, when they caught one operation in Nevada, in Las Vegas, they were putting on names of Major League Baseball players and basketball players and football players, because they were using people who couldn't come up with a bunch of names. And the end result is you have all these ballots that are out there in the wind, and when somebody marks them, they have the technology to take a look hard at what the signature is on them. And most of the systems have dialed that down to where they passed. In fact, I have voters who'll say, I'll sign my signature in an entirely different way than I normally do. I mean, you could do it, I could do it. And then send the ballot in, and it goes right on through. And you say, how is it that when I deliberately sign my name in a funny way, and then it goes through, what does that tell you about the system for checking signatures?
I totally agree with you. And the other thing that we have that's a problem is here in Michigan, we have thousands and thousands of people that are not supposed to be on the voter rolls. They should have been gone a long time ago. And there's some law that says you can only take off 1,000 people a year. Well, good Lord, that's going to take 100,000 years for us to get the extra people off.
That's how the Democrats plan to be in control for 100,000 years. Crystal, thanks for the call. Let's go to Gig Harbor and Keith. Keith, we're at about a minute from the break. What's up?
Oh, I understand. Two questions. Yep. One, and your comment about if the public should know about what's going on with the teacher negotiations and such. First of all, there's been a lot of negotiations that we haven't seen or heard that have put the unfunded liabilities into deep, deep, deep water all over. And I think that the teachers' negotiations is one of them. And secondly, you just talked with Steve Moore, and I like Steve, listening to him. He brought up one of the financial instruments.
Say it quick.
I forget what it is. But isn't that what the Oregon...
private equity? Yes, that's exactly how PERS got... But for you to do it, if you decide to accept the risk, that's okay. For PERS to do it...
The Lars Larson Show.